The first bill up on the agenda today is House File 544. Representative Markford, if you'd come to the table, please. Quorum is present. While Representative Markford is coming, Representative Wardlow, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
Yes, I have, Chair, and I move them.
Okay.
To be approved.
Representative Wardlow moves approval of the minutes from February 7, 2005. Any discussion? See none. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Thank you, members. Representative Markwood.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. A bill we have today, HF 544, is a bill that was developed by the District 9B Youth Council, which is a group of students who represent the various school districts in District 9B, and one of the major tasks of that group is to look at bills that they feel would help youth become more engaged and have more of an ownership in communities and so forth. So I have three members of that 9B Youth Council here today, and HF 544, and I'll let them explain the bill, but basically what it is an effort to get more youth involved on local boards and to get them more engaged in our local communities. So with that, I have three students, Michael Goldaddy from Breckenridge High School, Jessica Thompson from Dilworth Glenn and Felton High School, and Heather Dahl from Barnesville School. And with that, if I might, Mr. Chair, you and I had discussed a delete all. Is that ready?
Yes, we're waiting for copies, so we'll move the bill and bring everything before us when we get those here.
Okay, so we can proceed with testimony, Mr. Chair?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you. So I will turn it over to Mr. Goldaddy.
State your name for the record, please, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michael Goldaddy from Breckenridge High School. I'm also a junior there. The main idea for our bill is to get youth under the age of 21 to have the ability to be appointed to advisory boards and community-based boards. In the Minnesota Constitution, there is nothing regarding about age written about this in the requirements of community or youth advisory boards. In Article 7, Section 6 of the Minnesota Constitution, it states that a person needs to be 21 years of age or older to hold any office elected by the people in the district. There are no laws and age requirements for advisory boards or community-based boards. You can also be elected via an election judge trainee at age 16 or 17. And this is the election judge trainee application type of thing. And these are for advisory commission applications, and it's doesn't make you state an age at all for doing this.
Any questions? Do you want to wait for questions, Representative Markford?
Mr. Chair, if we could have the entire testimony and then entertain questions.
That's just fine. Thank you. Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jessica Thompson. I am from Dilworth Glenn and Felton High School. I'm here to tell you why we need this law. There are three reasons why we need this law. One, having this law would reduce the confusion for local units of government that think you must be 21 to be on an advisory board. Two, there is no current law that states whether a person under 21 can be disqualified from appointment to city, county, or township advisory boards. Three, this law will clear up some confusion for youth, as well as allowing them the opportunity to take part on these advisory boards. This also would encourage more cities to put youth on their boards.
Thank you. Again, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Heather Dahl, and I'm from Barnesville High School. Allowing younger people to be on advisory boards would benefit the whole community. This is important because it allows more youth under 21 to be active members. Youth are an essential part of the community. Being on a committee would give them a sense of ownership. Many decisions that are made by advisory boards regard or affect youth. so with more youth on the boards, they can hear directly from them. It is important that youth, alongside adults, contribute to society. Youth and adults can form partnerships to strive for the betterment of the community. Early involvement on an advisory board is a good learning process. A person under 21 can start out young and progressively learn throughout their experiences. If youth are active on advisory boards now, they will likely be involved later on in life. Youth under the age of 21 should be allowed to sit on advisory boards as voting members because active citizenship does not begin at the age of 21. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That concludes the testimony, but if we want now to, is the amendment ready? Not ready. Well, if I could, you mind if I explain that a little bit,
sure.
What we're going to do with. In conversations with the chair, what the delete all amendment, which I will move here, is going to do is going to set an age minimum of 16 years of age unless there is a youth commission. Some cities have youth commissions where it's set up just primarily for youth. They would be exempt from that. But if it's a regular advisory commission like a park board or a planning commission, the minimum age would be 16. And even as you kind of go through some of the search, the city of Burnsville, for example, they allow youth on their park board, and the requirement there is you have to be a junior in high school. And so I think 16 years of age would be a good limit, and the testifiers here also would agree with that. So, but in short, the statute is, there isn't anything on the book. And I think what happens is that a lot of cities may not think they can even put youth on less than 21 years of age, and this will open that up. This refers to counties, cities, and townships, does not include school districts. And the reason for that is because there's about 60 of the 340 school districts that do allow youth on their school boards. Not voting members, but advisory. And schools kind of already have a setup, just the students being the clients and so forth, that we thought we would just leave that alone and refer to the other entities. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for the testifiers or Representative Marquardt? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Marquardt, have you had any conversations with the cities or the townships or the counties in regards to your bill? Have there been any feedback to you? My understanding is they can already, if they want to bring students on and have them part of the advisory committee, they can do that without having to have a law to put in place. I haven't heard anybody saying we don't want young people involved with government.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that's exactly correct. There is not a law that prohibits, but there isn't a law that authorizes. And I do think this would clear up any confusion, clear up any potential liability that a city may incur if, in fact, someone says there isn't statutory authority to do this. And also the other premise is that just talking about this and putting an age in there may get more cities to think about doing that. It creates awareness of putting youth on more boards. But I have not been contacted by cities or counties or townships either way on this bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, in regards to the situation, I think I keep hearing we got a lot of laws on the books, and I keep hearing people say, why don't you get rid of some of the laws instead of add more laws to the books? And to me, if it's not broke, why try and fix something that's not broke? So I'm just concerned about adding more. I understand it's good intention and stuff, but I don't see why they can't do it already.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Marquardt, and thank you to the testifiers. I commend you on your leadership and initiative. I think this is wonderful that you're coming forward with this. I just have a question. You're from a district that perhaps has 4-H programs. I'm just wondering a question. How many of you have been involved in 4-H leadership? If any of you have, I just want to know, either a show of hands or just to know that. Are you involved in that? Thank you. to one out of the three. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question, Representative, is can I assume that Record Ridge, Dilworth, and Barnesville councils don't allow this to happen? They don't have youth on their different boards, planning commissions and stuff? Because most of the cities that I'm aware of in the metro area do have them. And then I have a follow-up question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson. Well, in fact, when I was mayor in Dilworth, we always left a position open on the planning and park boards for that. But for the most part, many of the cities, or most, do not actually do that. And, you know, this in no way would discourage any of those current practices. But I do think, and some of the people I've talked to were not aware, in fact, that people under 21 could serve on these boards. And the fact that in the state constitution, you have to be 21 to run for any office, kind of sets that as a mindset, if you will, on what people can serve. And as Representative Anderson said, I think things would go along just fine without this bill. I do think, however, that this bill will encourage and bring to light the fact that youth can be on boards, and I think would encourage more membership. Both cities going out and allowing youth to be on it, but also youth applying to be on these boards.
Representative Peterson?
Thank you. Follow-up question. In those cases where you have charter cities, are they going to have to change the charter to do that?
Representative Marquardt or...
Mr. Chair and Representative Peterson and Representative Lanning, you came from a charter city. Maybe you would know this better, but I don't know where there would be a change at the charter cities, but I know we have some people from the league possibly that maybe could answer that.
I would imagine that if it's mentioned in the city charter, that then there would be a requirement to, or you would have a problem there, but... Does someone from the League of Cities wish to respond to that?
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Paymore.
Charter Commission meets, it's not a big deal to change the charter. Charter Commission meets periodically. It's a fairly simple process, so if it needs to get done, I served on two charter commissions. And
Mr. Eisen, you have some information about this?
Mr. Chair, under the bill as introduced, it says city, and under Chapter 410 of the statutes, when you say city without specifying statutory or home rule charter, it means only statutory cities. So in the bill as introduced, it would be only statutory cities that would be prohibited from disqualifying or prohibited from having... ordinances or provisions that prevent people from under 21 serving. The delete all amendment specifies it applies to home rule charter cities as well as statutory cities. So if there is a charter provision that is contrary to if the committee adopts the delete all amendment and it's enacted, home rule charter cities would have to conform to this provision.
Thank you for the clarification. Representative Peterson, follow-up, or does that take care of your question?
Thank you.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Marquardt. I think this is a good bill. I really appreciate you bringing it forward. I think, involving citizens in general, but particularly youth in our government is a great thing. My question is, presumably these advisory boards have criteria. They're looking for certain kind of representation or certain qualifications. There's a process that these cities use to appoint folks to advisory boards. Presumably, the youth would be in the mix in that whole process. Is that correct?
Representative Marquardt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Horstein, that's exactly correct. Remember that these are all advisory boards. They would not be boards that would have a final decision. It would ultimately go through the city council or the county board or the township board. And they also have to be, of course, appointed by the city council. So it still allows the city council to decide who they want on the boards. And many of the cities do have application forms that ask you such things as, you know, state your reasons for requesting to be on the advisory board or describe your education experience which qualifies you to serve on this commission. So every city does it a little differently, but it still would have to be approved by the city council or that authority.
Thank you.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. I'd say give the guy a break here. it's an advisory board, for goodness sake, and I don't think we want to send these folks home with a signal that we don't want kids or young people on our advisory boards. It doesn't mandate anything, and we've passed a lot screwier laws than this. So I would say it would be a good signal. We want young people involved in government, and it would be a good thing to do.
Representative Postman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Markwart, in the delete everything amendment on line 9, starting with the sentence, the governing board, that limits that there may only be one youth on the board. I don't think that's necessarily your intention. And so I would ask if you'd like me to move to delete that section, because what if someone wants two youths on their board? Then it wouldn't allow it. Is that correct?
Representative Markwart.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, first of all, can I move this DE1 amendment? It hasn't been moved yet. If I could move that.
Please.
Okay, I move the DE1 amendment. Representative Hillstrom, this was put in after discussion with the chair, and kind of a compromise, if you will, but it would be that if there were, for example, two positions open on an advisory board at the same time, and there was a couple youth and others older than 21 that you could only put one youth on at a time. And, I think it probably is restricting the wishes of what a city council or county board may wish. But I'm willing to move forward with that on the compromise. But
Mr. Chair.
I should point out before we go on here that given our 24-hour rule, we have to make sure everyone is comfortable with waiving that rule in order to hear this amendment. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mark, what would you be comfortable with saying unless the position is designated as a youth position? You know, therefore, if they wanted to have two positions on the advisory board designated as a youth position, they certainly could do that, but it wouldn't exempt them from being part of the mix as well. Does that help?
Representative Markwart.
Yeah, Representative Lanning, Representative Hillstrom, that would be fine. I think that probably would be fine. Now, remember, this delete all amendment does not apply to any youth commissions that are established for just youth. A number of cities have those, so it would not impact that. They can have as many youth as they want on those boards, but I guess whatever the committee would like on this. Either way.
Are there any objections to our waiving the 24-hour rule and proceeding to consider the delete all? Hearing none, we will do so. Are there further questions or discussion? If not, Representative Markwart, would you renew your motion and indicate what you would propose to do with the legislation?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to renew my motion for the DE1 amendment on House File 544. And I guess I'm going to ask the chair where this would proceed to next.
As I understand, it would go to the general register, recommend to pass, and be placed in the general register.
Okay, I would go along with that motion then for the general register.
Okay. We'll vote first on the delete everything amendment as proposed. All in favor of the delete everything amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. Then we need to vote on the bill as amended. All in favor of the bill as amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carried.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you so much.
And a special thank you to the students that come from up in God's country. We're very glad to have you with us, and thank you for your willingness to serve your communities. And thank you for being here today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bernstein.
While we're transitioning to the new bill, I just wanted to ask Representative Howe why he's wearing a life vest.
The governor was, his budget was drowning me, so I needed to get a boat. No, seriously, I saw outside, it was pretty cool, I thought I'd put it on. No, in support of the small cabin owners.
Okay. You do attract attention, Representative Tom. Yes, Representative Sharon.
I would like to propose a rule change for a committee in imposing a dress code for members of the committee.
Look at the yoke. I like jacket.
Specifically mention Hunter's orange, right? The next item on our agenda is House File 568. Representative Marquardt, welcome back to the committee.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This is a less controversial bill. members, House File 568 is referring to the 60-day rule, and of course, just a little background, this was first passed in 1995 and was changed a little bit in 2003. But in short, what it does is that if there is a request made of an agency regarding zoning or septic systems or expansion of the metropolitan urban service area, that agency has 60 days in which to deny or approve that permit. Now, during that 60-day time, they may, during that initial time, may ask for another 60-day extension to that. And what this bill does is it takes cities under 10,000, and there is an amendment I'm going to be, and maybe I should do that first, that will include townships. But what it will do, it will move those 60-day time frames to 90-day time frames. And so, Mr. Chair, if I could, I think members should have an amendment.
Why don't you first make your motion with regard to the bill, and then we'll consider an amendment.
Okay, I will.
I understand it needs to go to Commerce.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move approval of House File 568, and to forward on to the Commerce Committee.
And is there an amendment that is coming before us, or is before us? Okay, you're going to move the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will then move the A1 amendment.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, the impact of this is to add townships to this bill. I have a number of testifiers, and then I believe there is the loyal opposition. We'll have some time then, Mr. Chair, if I could have a few comments after everyone's made their comments.
Certainly.
Okay, at this time I'd like to call Laura Offerdahl from the League of Minnesota Cities and Kent Sullivan from Minnesota Township Association, and who would like to go first?
Representative Marquardt, maybe if you would like, we should act on your amendment first to get it officially to vote on your amendment, or we could do it later too, whichever.
Maybe now to get it in the working order,
okay.
Mr. Chair, if we could.
Okay. You have before you the A1 amendment. All in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Proceed. Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee,
My name is Kent Sulem. I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Association of Townships. Representative Marquardt actually brought this bill to my attention a couple of weeks ago when he was asked to carry the jackets for it and asked if I was in favor or opposed to it. And I said, well, at this current stage, after reading it, I would be neutral because it didn't apply to townships. So I thank you for the amendment that would treat us equally with our city colleagues. The 60-day rule is one that has been a problem for all local units of government since the day it was adopted. And at the township level, what I can tell you is most of the violations that I have seen, the court cases that I have seen, usually involve things where the town board receives a petition, and the normal process is the clerk will receive a petition for one of the variants or conditional use permit or something of that nature related to zoning. Of course, the clerk can't act on it alone, so they wait for the next board meeting. Most town boards meet once a month, so that first 30 days you're frequently seeing disappear waiting for the meeting to just get scheduled and on the calendar, and then they have essentially 30 days for the town board to act on it, which leads to the need for extensions. Unfortunately, what happens a lot of times is that they'll say, okay, we'll defer to the next meeting, and if you don't count the calendar days very carefully, that next month's meeting may be 31 days and not 30 days from the day of the first meeting, and so now you're at day 61, day 62, and while they're trying to do everything properly, they get caught up on a counting game and end up having automatic approval of the action requested because they were acting on day 61 instead of day 62. The advantage of this amendment, or the bill here as amended, would be in these small communities that do not have staff, they will actually be giving them the original intent of the bill. It gives them essentially 60 days to act. Just remember that first month is essentially lost waiting for the board to meet so the clerk can bring the application to them. It simply will help, I think, in the end result. What you'll see is fewer extensions because they'll actually have the longer original period of time to act on things. They won't have as much of a need to have to extend just to accommodate board schedules, and you may actually see things acted on in a more expedited fashion. Can I guarantee that? No. But I think that as a matter of practice, you may see that occurring because you'll be giving them more accommodation under their normal meeting schedules to handle the applications. And so even though this did not arise from our association, we would ask your full support for this this bill.
Ms. Offerdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Laura Offerdahl, and here representing the League of Minnesota Cities. The League of Cities does have a policy supporting some additional time for smaller cities to have to review land use and zoning requests. And so we are here in support of this legislation today. Back when this law was passed in 1995, the intent was really to ensure that local governments and other agencies would act quickly on zoning other land use requests and to give sort of the applicants more certainty in the process. However, this has been a problem for a lot of the smaller cities, smaller communities, because what you see in a lot of the smaller communities is that they do not have dedicated planning staff to review these kinds of requests. And as Kent mentioned, they often meet monthly as well, and so that is a challenge to get these requests before the council within that 60-day time period. Furthermore, cities do need adequate time to really carefully analyze these requests. Sometimes it can be very complicated. And to give them enough time to really do their homework, to thoughtfully consider the request, and to prepare their findings, whether it's an approval or a denial of the application, they need some time to do that work. And so we believe that this bill would, as amended, would give cities and towns the extra time they need to thoughtfully consider these requests. And we urge you to support the bill.
Any questions for Representative Marquardt or testifiers? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sulem, you mentioned something about 60-day extensions. How many 60-day extensions are applied for now in the year by the townships or is offered all by the cities?
Representative, I should say, Mr. Sewell. I just promoted you.
Thank you for the promotion. Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I really do not have any statistics. We do not track the number of applications that are coming in. If I were to simply take a guess, I would say that there's a majority that are probably exercising their extension right, if nothing else, just because they're concerned about how we, you know, looking at the calendar date, do our meetings line up so we get the 60 days counted. I am only going to be able to speculate, but I'd say a majority of them are probably having to take advantage of the 60-day extension just to make sure they don't run afoul and end up having an automatic approval. And that's something to remember. The penalty, if you will, for violating 1599 is automatic approval of whatever is asked for, regardless of how that request complies or fails to comply with the standards of the community. So it's a pretty harsh result, particularly for missing it by one day while you're trying to get the meeting scheduled. And so I think you see a lot of communities feeling compelled to try to exercise the right of extension just to buy themselves the safety time. And this would provide them the statutory safeguards so you don't run afoul by 1 or 2 days.
Representative Anderson, Mr. Chair, assuming we're... Ms. Lockerdahl, are the extensions requested by the town or the small cities denied on a regular basis? Mr. Sewell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, right now, with the way the statute is set up and as it would remain with the amendment, the initial right of extension is an automatic right of the local units. It isn't something that is subject to a challenge under the existing statute. Like I said, my belief is that with the proper training, what you'd find is less... The extensions are still going to be needed, but I think you may see less extensions if they have the initial time up front. I can't promise that because, as Ms. Offerdahl said, without the staff, without a number of experts in-house, it takes a lot more time for the small communities to gather the data and the information to go out, do the site surveys and inspections that are required to coordinate the schedule. So extensions are still going to be needed, but I think you may see a decline in the number of automatic extensions just because, like I said, you lose essentially the first 30 days waiting for the boards or the city councils to come together to even acknowledge that an application is there.
Thank you. Ms. Offerdahl, you made the argument that smaller cities and towns need this kind of flexibility in order to move forward in considering these things, given their limited resources, limited staff. Is there a point at which the size of a city maybe tips the other way, where this kind of legislation would cause problems in delay of developments, that larger cities are perhaps better equipped to process and deal with?
Mr. Chair, I guess I would have to say that this bill would cover, and most of our cities are under 2,500 population. Over 600 of them, I'm not sure of the exact number, are under 2,500 population. So I would think that those are the ones that we are certainly most concerned about. Our policy does support increasing the time limit for cities under 5,000. I'm not sure if there's a threshold for more metropolitan-type communities or communities that are developing where this might be an issue. I do know I did receive an email from the city of Robbinsdale. They're about 14,000 population, and they indicated to me that they have trouble getting these applications reviewed in time to meet the 60-day requirement. So I guess I don't have a definitive answer for you, but that's what I've heard from some of our
communities. So does league policy specify the size of the community below which this is a problem?
Mr. Chair, our policy does support extending the deadline to 90 days for communities under 5,000.
Under 5,000 by current policy.
Current policy.
Representative Scalzi.
Yes,
Yeah, I just wanted to comment that in a lot of cases where cities deal with these type of issues, you're dealing with probably park commissions and planning commissions, and they typically meet once a month. And so depending on the time, the scheduling of those commission meetings, I know in our city where I was on a city council, we would sometimes have trouble so that, and we had a good staff so that they were alert. But if you don't have a really alert staff, I mean, it's very difficult to make sure that all these things get taken care of. And then the other comment I would make would be that most of the smaller communities maybe have a weekly newspaper, and you do want to alert your constituency so that the citizens know what's being proposed. So depending on the time, the timing of when they go to press and when they deliver their newspapers, it may seem like cities and townships are maybe taking too much time, but in lots of cases, for the citizens to discuss it and come and give some input takes a little bit of time, and that may be what the League of Minnesota Cities is getting at with some of these issues.
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair, I would just like to follow up on that. Representative Scalzi raised an excellent point. In the rural areas of the state, most of your newspaper publications are weekly at best, and that weekly publication deadline rarely coincides with the night of the local meetings. State statute under 462 requires cities and townships to provide 10 days published notice of public hearings related to such things as a variance or a conditional use permit. And so you've got to get a minimum of 10 days notice. You've got to meet the deadlines of the filing of the newspaper to get the hearing scheduled. You can easily see 2-3 weeks disappear just coordinating with the newspaper. The other thing I'd like to point out that was also the representative raised was we've been talking about the difficulty of getting the town board or the city council together, but a number of these issues are required to go to the planning commission before the board actually acts on it, which means you're now trying to get two bodies scheduled in rural areas where you're dealing with volunteers and trying to get the notices out and get things scheduled, and now you're trying to get two groups to meet within that original 60 days, and so that 90-day window would be a much more practical use for trying to get two groups together.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Markwart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, of course, there's many small cities. I mean, we're talking 100, 200. In fact, in District 9B, the city of Tenney has 6 people. And so you might have not even one full-time clerk. And if it is a complicated zoning issue, not only are you going to have to get the attorney up to speed, but if you think you need some advice from a planner, you may have to do RFPs, which take an extended amount of time. So for a lot of these small cities, it really becomes problematic if you're trying to meet the 60-day requirement, or even if you're counting the extension, 120 days.
Representative Markwart, does that conclude your testimony at this point?
It does, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We do have a number of folks who have wished to come forward and speak in opposition to this legislation. Call on, first of all, representing the Builders Association of Minnesota, Mr. Peter Coyle, and Michael Goman.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Coyle, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. My name is Peter Coyle. I'm a lawyer lobbyist from the Larkin Hoffman Law Firm. I represent the Statewide Builders Association of Minnesota. Their executive director, Pam Weaver, is here today. I also represent the Builders Association of the Twin Cities. In my night job, I represent builders, developers, and property owners at city councils and town halls and county boards around the state. And so I see this issue in real life working with my clients, and I don't see the problem that, frankly, that this bill is attempting to address. We've got with us today a couple of folks who will testify in opposition to the bill, and I'm certainly pleased to respond to any questions if you have any for me. But Mike Goman is a member of his family's construction company. Mike will lead off. And then Jane D. Austin is the executive director for the St. Cloud Area Builders, and she's here to speak on behalf of her members. And then there are, Mr. Chairman, several others who wish to speak very briefly as a wrap-up. Thank you for your time today, members.
Mr. Coyle, would you please state your name for the record so that we have that on record?
You bet. My name is Peter Coyle, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Goman. And please identify yourself for the record, too, please.
My name is Michael Goldman. I represent W. Goldman Construction Company. I'm the executive vice president there. We do work in and around the St. Cloud area. We're actually based in St. Joseph. We do both residential and commercial just in that local area. Primarily, you know, the cities that I work in, of the six cities that we work in, St. Cloud is the only one that is over 10,000 in population. So, I mean, I'm used to dealing with smaller municipalities all the time, and I find that it's actually easier for me to deal with those, to work with the city of St. Joseph than it is to work with the city of St. Cloud, just because of the layers of government and the extra people that I have to talk to and to work through those issues. And, as a local person, I know those people. Some of the other issues that arise, I mean, if this gets extended as a contractor in Minnesota, 30 days might all of a sudden put you into, the winter season, which in essence puts, the whole schedule maybe 6 months more behind schedule and dramatically increases carrying costs. When you deal with, interest payments and everything on the land that you're holding, as well as real estate taxes and the rest. And, just the longer that it delays, the more the cost becomes, and then that ends up getting passed along to either the homeowner or the end user if it's a commercial building. So the other thing that, with a lot of the smaller municipalities you work with, I mean, they have the right to hire consultants. And, they hire a consultant, and then, I as a developer, I get charged for those consulting fees. So, they have the ability to get experts that can, lay things out, for the municipality, stating, how it is, and, goes through in a timely manner. So, I guess that's, to wrap up, that's really, I guess, this can create a, significant change to the way that construction does happen.
Yes, please identify yourself.
Thank you. I'm Jane D. Austin. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Central Minnesota Builders Association in the St. Cloud area. We're an association of members in the housing industry. We have about 550 members representing over 11,000 employees. Our territory goes from St. Cloud, Little Falls, east to the Wisconsin border. The only city that we really deal with over the 10,000 threshold is St. Cloud. And I just want to let you know that the 60-day rule has not been an issue in our area. We're working within it if necessary to extend it. It is not an issue for our builders. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, a couple of final comments before the others speak against the bill. We've handed out to the members a blue flyer. You see listed below it other organizations that have indicated their opposition to the proposed legislation. They're not going to testify today, but we simply wanted to indicate to you that there is a broad level of concern about the harm that this bill would cause if it were to be enacted. And we think that cities have ample opportunities to address these planning issues in a way that can be coordinated with the developers' interests, and we're certainly prepared to work with cities on those issues on a daily basis. Thank you very much for your time, Mr. Chairman, members, unless you have questions for the panel before we step down.
We'll take questions at this point or comments. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Crowell, I guess maybe I'd address this to Mr. Goldman. When does the 60-day trigger pop for you? How many meetings have you had with that city and the planning and the city manager? How much information do they have prior to you actually writing the check for the permit, submitting final site and building plans? I mean, what's the lead time that goes up? Because I'm concerned that the 60-day is being treated like it's tomorrow morning, and talk through that experience.
I guess Mr. Goldman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The 60-day rule doesn't start until the application is 100% complete. So if you omit something or don't have a piece of information or whatever that the government is looking for that you're trying to get to the municipality, the 60-day rule doesn't start. The application and all of everything has to be, 100% complete before that rule starts. So, you always end up talking about a project just them and, kind of seeing, what you try to get a feeling as to where things are at. And I mean, that can be, if it's a small item, it might only be a couple of weeks, but more often, it's already, 2 or 3 months that goes on. I mean, if you acquire a piece of property that you write a purchase agreement on, you're making that contingent upon all of these potential changes. And I mean, you know, that process you're going through with soil borings and other issues for environmental things that you're trying to make sure. So I mean, the entity, you know, you're working with them and they know what's happening, you know, before you actually get to the point of submitting your application. Like I said, that has to be, you know, completed in full before the 60-day rule starts.
Representative Peterson?
Thank you, let me clarify, though. In my city, the planning people tell the developers, don't you dare talk to the city council and don't you dare talk to the mayor until his staff or her staff has an opportunity to get it in a form. In your particular case, in cities of this size, who are you talking to? When you say you're talking to them, who would them be?
Mr. Bowman.
Like in the city of St. Joseph, I mean, they have consultants that are hired for development, to work on development for the city. So I mean, if I have somebody that I'm working with or myself that has an idea, I mean, you call them up and say, is this seem feasible? Is this, what's your feeling for this in the marketplace? Or I have a client that's coming in and would like to do, a building in this area. So I mean, like I said, I mean, they have, the city of St. Joseph has consultants. In other towns, it's, it's somebody that you know. I mean, it's, probably depending upon each town is a little bit different. But like I said, in the city of St. Joseph, we do a lot of our business, we deal with their consultants right away.
Any other questions or comments to be directed at these witnesses before we call on the others who wish to speak? Representative Lancheski.
Thank you, Chairman Lanning. I have a question for Mr. Coyle. Maybe he's the wrong one, but I think he'd know the answer. And I don't represent a small city, so it's probably... I just don't really understand how it works in small cities, and maybe Mr. Coyle knows. There's two, the way I look at it, there's a couple things that cities can do as they review these things. They can use this limited time to give them as much time as they can get, the current law. And then if that isn't working, now this is how it works in a larger city, so this may not apply, they can go to a moratorium process. So the way I look at it is the better way to look at the number is what's the total number combined between the two sets of processes that a city council can use to take all the time it needs. And Mr. Coyle, do you know we made some changes last year, or maybe it was the year before, I can't even recall, and we had a lot of debate on the moratorium part of the process, not this part of the process. But before those changes were enacted to reduce the amount of the moratorium months, what was the total of the two processes combined, let's say, 3 years ago? And what is it today? Because I think that it's already been dramatically reduced, hasn't it? The two combined.
Mr. Kwa.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Lancheski, the bill that you're referring to that was dealt with last year affirmed the existing 12-month moratorium authority that cities have today, so that if they get into a complicated application and they're not prepared to take an action, cities today can unilaterally impose development moratoria that extend for 12 months and nothing can happen on the application. Prior to that time, the statute gave the cities 12 months plus an additional 18 months. Now, the language that got passed last year reserved that 18-month authority in the event there is some other approval that's required from a state or a federal agency that the community has to have before they can take their final action. So in the rare case that there's a federal environmental question that hasn't been addressed, the city can defer taking their final action on the moratorium until all the information is presented. So back to Mr. Goldman's comments. Assuming that the city has specified 10 things that they have to have before the application will be considered complete, the clock doesn't begin to tick. It may take you 12 months to get all the questions answered before you've got a complete application. That's not that unusual. Hopefully not frequent, but it does happen. So the clock doesn't begin to run until you have a complete application, and the city decides what's a complete application. Our job is to respond and to cooperate as best we can. And in the worst case, where they run out of time, last year the city's asked for the authority to create for kind of a mutual extension right in statute, and the builders and the developers agreed to that change just to try to provide another opportunity to work it out when there's something that's still missing.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Winchester.
Mr. Chair, follow-up. Thank you. And I guess what I'm thinking with that, just so other committees members know, because I'm really torn on this bill. I mean, I really do not want developers and people interacting with government unnecessarily being slowed down. I think that's wrong. And, in fact, I would argue that the building permit process should also be in this. Many cities operated for years thinking it was, and then I think a court ruling said it isn't, and I'd like it back in. So I don't want to go against developers who are trying to, you know, there are land costs when you hold land and you can't act. But I know that Representative Marquardt would never try to unnecessarily make things really difficult in that arena. And so I guess the part of the thing I'm torn on is I think cities are already feeling that they have lost, when you add the times together, a significant chunk of time. And in my own city, and maybe this doesn't apply to small cities, we had a real heck of a time meeting the 12-month plus the 18-month extension after we couldn't meet the development part. And because when you have issues like extensions of runways, and there are huge issues that come before communities, and they can't get these things done. So trying to find that middle ground, and I think people here, they want to be pro-city or pro-business, and as someone who wants to be both, it's, you know, how do you find something reasonable? And we should try as a committee to really do that and figure out something that works for everyone. So,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lencheski, just very briefly, with respect to that airport planning question, there was a specific exception created in the statute last year when it went to committee that reserved that additional 18-month authority for cities when they're dealing with airport planning issues. St. Cloud had a concern, and it was intended to help protect them. And I recall that the airport authority in the Twin Cities also wanted that authority preserved. And that was something that we had no problem agreeing to. Those are our comments this morning, Mr. Chairman, unless there are other questions that we could respond to before the other panelists speak.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. We have Elisa Schlander and Susan Diori. Begging your pardon if I don't pronounce that correctly.
Yes.
And Glenn Dorf. Not on the list, but welcome all of you to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Alyssa Schlander. I represent the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. We are the group that represents all the franchise new car dealers in Minnesota. My association has been interested in land use and development issues here at the Capitol for the last several years because my members, especially those in the metropolitan area, have indicated to us that local government regulation has become a significant factor in preventing our industry from growing. I think just about any business can tell you, you know, if they've been involved in a development or a building project, that the municipality has considerable power over a property owner. And therefore, our position has been to uphold legislation that erodes property owners' rights when these things arise here. Delays in a project mean time is lost and money is wasted. And I think, you know, any unnecessary delay in a project is going to cause problems for a property owner. The 60-day rule or the 120-day rule, as I guess it really ought to be called, has been really an incredibly important law that assures property owners that their project will, you know, their applications will be handled in a timely manner. I'll sum up because Mr. Coyle and his witnesses, you know, explained the problems of property owners just fine. I guess just in sum, we just think this bill is unnecessary because there are several tools that local governments have right now in their toolbox that allow them to deal with any unique situations that may arise. And you know, 4 months is quite a long time to deal with an application. You think some years a whole legislative session only lasts 4 months, and so you know if we can get this work done, you think we can maybe act on an application within 4 months. So that's all I have to add. Thank you for the time to comment.
Thank you. Ms. Moon, welcome to the committee, Mr. Dorf.
Thank you. I'm here for Susan Diori. My name is Glenn Dorf, and I represent the Minnesota Association of Realtors. I just have a few new points. One I'd like to ask the committee to be sure I'm right. On page 2, there was this amendment that was on this, I'm sorry, on lines 13 through 15. We added this, or a town, after on line 15, after the word population.
I think the intent is, or a town under 10,000. That's not what this language says. So you need to put, or a town prior to charter city. Otherwise, there are towns that are over 10,000, and unless your intent is to cover them, I would respectfully ask you to think that out in terms of the placement of the words. The only other things that I'd like to say is, number one, we all have, I suppose, after this many years working together, we all have some ownership. We brought you this legislation in 93. It passed both bodies unanimously, bipartisan and unanimously. And the argument we made in 93, I'd just like to remind you of one more time. Government is a monopoly. I'm not being pejorative. It's a monopoly. The only place a builder or a developer or a homeowner can get a permit to do something is from government. They can't go to Sears. They're not competing on price. They have to donate. They have to donate parkland. They have to do what the city tells them to do in order to get a permit. And oftentimes, they have to do some things that, over the years, I personally, having studied it with a lot of the developers and the builders, have found a little silly. I live in the city of Shoreview, lovely city, great place. We have what you call the most spectacular downtown area I've ever seen. Very nice. Nobody voted on it, but it's lovely. The point I'm trying to make is that because we don't, in the small cities cases, one of the things that they didn't bring up is they do have the right today to hire in a consultant. We know that most small cities don't have tons of development going on. So it's sort of an extreme argument to say that small cities are backlogged. The cities that we're mostly concerned about are cities that have Rochester, and I'm going to talk just briefly about that example, the Rochester to Zumbrota, and then the example of Cannon Falls to Minneapolis, which we're all very concerned about not slowing down. Now, I think there'll be unanimous agreement on this because it's going to benefit the whole state. So the time, cost, money, that's been talked about. The fact that developers don't pay carrying costs, they pass them on. And we brought the legislation to you because we were in the middle of talking about a housing crisis. We said, oh, housing is radically expensive. And we said, well, one of the component parts of the expense is waiting what we thought was an extraordinary period of time for a monopoly to decide whether or not it was going to act in our behalf. We didn't think it was unreasonable. And frankly, most cities have not had any problem with this. City of Duluth had a problem because they didn't do it right. So they had a problem. And then they come running to the legislature last year and say, oh, we have to fix my problem because the court said we were wrong. Well, that's the reason we put the statute in, so that there would be some accountability. So we very much appreciate your thinking about the fact that we really are the developers and builders of the private sector. We are absolutely at the mercy of cities. These are not bad people. I am not suggesting that. But there is no competition, so there's no incentive for them to act. And I know there are a lot of things that people say, well, Glenn, what about the environmental people? They have to come in. All that's absolutely true. But, you know, if you're interested in tax base and you're interested in growing jobs in Minnesota, then the cities should start meeting more regularly than once a month. I heard somebody say that earlier. I mean, think about the private sector. Somebody comes into a real estate office and we say, you know, I know you're interested in seeing houses. We'll get to you in about a month or so. I mean, they're going to do that because another realtor who's in competition is going to say, I'll show you the house in 10 seconds because I'd like a chance to get some money from you. So my major point here today is that we do need to increase, on a bipartisan basis, government accountability, because it's costing the citizens, your constituents, money. My people are not paying the costs. Those developers are very clever. That's the reason the successful ones are so successful. So, and that's also the reason we have housing that is going up in the state at a cost that is probably, according to the Rutgers University Department of Housing, 25% of housing costs today are regulation related. I would argue to you that 15% of that is probably quite justifiable. 10% is not. That's a lot of cost when you're talking about a $300,000 house. Or an $80,000 house. So I'd like you to think about that. And then the last thing, and I very much appreciate your time, is the fact that the example that I gave, and this is another reason why I think we need to strengthen this law, not to make it less strong. Between now and 2010 or 12, there's going to be a growth
between Minneapolis, the University of Minnesota Medical School, and Cannon Falls and beyond, and between Rochester, and you're being asked, the governor's put some dough in for the Rochester campus. I don't think it's anywhere near enough, but it's my own personal view. and we'll have some suggestions as the session proceeds for where to get the money without raising taxes, because apparently those are the rules this year. And we have some ideas. I mean, there are campuses in Minnesota that have no students on, and we should close them down. And we should take the money from those campuses and move them to the campuses where there will be students. That's just rational thinking, I think. The argument I would make is that the Zumbrota-Rochester corridor and the corridor between Minneapolis and Cannon Falls right now are owned, most of that land, you can all check this out, most of that land is owned by half a dozen people. The University of Minnesota and Rochester are two of the most premier medical facilities in the country, and they are doing, in cooperation with other universities and medical centers, genome research. And that genome research, according to my wife, who knows a lot about these things, it includes things like the MIT. MIT just invented something called a bot, and Minnesota is working on this stuff. And a bot is a microscopic robot that you inject into a port in an arm, and the bot carries genome material and only cures the cancer, only eats the cancer that is irrelevant, so it doesn't bother other dead cells like hair follicles and so on. So it's targeted specifically.
Mr. Dorfman?
Yes.
Could you get...
Yeah. No, I will.
You will?
Yeah. The reason this is so important is because the growth of that corridor is not only going to have regional value, it's going to have international value. And if what we're going to do here is we're going to say on a regular basis, well, the cities don't meet very regularly, you know, well, they're going to have to meet more regularly because their tax bases are not shrinking like the states. And that's the last piece, is the city budgets are not going down. Their tax bases have expanded, just like township tax bases have expanded, and they don't have to raise their tax capacity rates to take more money off the tax base. So there are potentials, in this very small city's cases, of hiring consultants, and in the more modest city cases, 5,000 or so on, certainly either hiring consultants or using property tax revenue to ensure this growth occurs. Because on the one hand, we all say there isn't enough money, and on the other hand, we're going to stop the growth of a tax base that permits us to generate the money that permits the development. So, and I really do appreciate your... Because I'm a little nuts. I appreciate it. No, I do, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Dorfman, I wasn't going to put it that way. People who are very detailed. And I knew you'd get to the point eventually.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. You're very kind.
Point well taken.
Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Dorfman or Ms. Schillender? Seeing none? Any other testimony for or against the bill? House Bill 568. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I was just wondering if the mayor from the city of Grant is here, and I didn't see him earlier. Is he here? Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, I have three quick comments, if I might. And then, number one, this is, in fact, a hardship for a number of smaller cities and townships. And, in fact, with the extension, I believe it may actually help some developments, because right now a city can, within those 60 days, just deny it. If they feel they're being rushed and hurried, then come up with a reason and deny it. But they may want this development. By having some extra time, may in fact help the project. And the last point I want to make is that city councils are responsible for everyone. They're responsible for the entire city, all the residences, and they have to look long term at things. And while if you look at the 90 days and the 90 days, you know, and think 180 days, but 180 days may be very short time and compared to how long a city or township may have to live with a hurried up, unanalyzed situation that turns out bad in the long run. So those are my comments, and I appreciate the consideration of the committee.
Representative Marquardt, Mr. Dorfman did raise a point, and you seem to acknowledge it as you were sitting there. Did you have any comments in regards to his point regarding townships and being under 10,000 or over?
Mr. Chair, in talking to Mr. Solem, that would involve one township, White Bear Lake, which has a population of 11,000. So we want to change it for one, and it's 11,000 there. I would think just include all townships.
Okay. Any other discussion? Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was nice seeing some friendly faces testify too, I must say. But as you know, a recently former mayor, I just wanted to talk about this bill. I think currently, as the law is stated, I think it provides accountability on both ends. In St. Joseph, we did extend the time frame several times, and it was justifiable for many reasons. But at this point, I think any developer that really is committed to seeing a project move forward is going to do all their homework and submit all applicable material to the city. If it's not all submitted, that time frame doesn't start. And I think that's very important. So if the city feels uncomfortable that they don't have all the information needed, they can request more. And I also have to say, with frequency of meetings and for lack of staff, I think cities and townships do have ways that they can meet more often or provide for professional services. That's all billable to any person making a proposal to this, for development. So I think that's also a way that cities can still meet the needs of a 60-day requirement and still have the professional services needed to analyze any proposal. And I think most importantly is that the cities have the right to extend this time period for any reason. I think 120 days is quite enough, and I think it makes a city accountable to make a decision. I think sometimes we're too reluctant to make the tough decisions, and if we don't have a time frame pushing us to make those tough decisions, they just keep getting put off. And I think this is a mechanism to make sure that that decision is made. If there is any hesitancy, I think the requirement should be for the city to say, we're not ready for this and we're going to have to deny it. And if there's that threat, the developer is also going to make any measure possible to meet the needs of that city or to meet those concerns. So I don't support this. I understand the concern, but I think there's enough provisions to make sure that any issue can be addressed, whether it's through extending the time frame, a moratorium, or just flat out denying the project.
Representative Scalzi.
The only thing I would add, and because I've had to deal with this in the past, is that if you have the 60 and then you ask for the extra 60, now you're at 120. And I think on behalf of the developers and the people who are trying to do good work, 90 days may make that extra extension less numerous than we have done in the past. And maybe that answers your question, Larry, about the fact that you've had a lot of extensions. If you had 90 days, I think that would really be better for the builders. That's my only comment.
Any Representative Hosh?
I would just like to respond to that. I mean, I don't think we had many extensions, but when an extension was warranted, it was done. 90 days, I think you can really run into the same situation. I think what you run into is a reluctance to make a decision, not because of lack of information, but because of a fear of making a difficult decision. 120 days to get information is, I believe, substantial enough to be able to gather as much information as one needs. And like I said, there's always a provision where if they don't feel comfortable, they can deny the project, or they can do a moratorium. I think there's a lot of different tools and mechanisms to be able to deal with the concerns still. And I wish I could support it because I like Representative Marquardt a great deal, and I sit next to him on the floor, so he might get upset. But I think there's enough provisions already.
See no further discussion. Oops. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You will see my name as a co-author on this bill because... as Representative Lincheski said, we tend to be pro-local government, those of us who come out of local government. And I am sympathetic to the problem for smaller cities and townships and having the resources available to properly and expeditiously deal with these things. But I'm also sympathetic from a business point of view to the potential problems. For those communities that are experiencing growth, if we do things, enact regulations that slow down that growth, that's going to be to their detriment. And I think there is a point at which this could be problematic for larger cities, and that's why I asked the question of a representative from the League of Cities. I don't know what population number that is, because I know some cities that are maybe 2,500, 3,000 that are very good at expediting things, and others that would have more difficulty doing that. But I think there is a point at which this could be a problem. And so I express some concern about the bill.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Markwart, I don't have any small cities. I do sympathize with them, however, having served on the City Council. However, I am going to vote against your bill, but I just wanted to applaud you on getting both the League of Minnesota Cities and the Township Association on the same side. So, congratulations.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Any further discussion? Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one clarifying question that I know it maybe has been asked. How often does this happen? How do you have quite a need within your region, or is it something that you've heard about more statewide? I'm curious about that.
Yeah. Representative Markwart. Mr. Chair and Representative Hoppe, I'm not aware of specific problems in my district. I do know, especially when the bill was passed a few years ago, that there were concerns. And what I've heard in talking with League of Minnesota Cities and Township representatives, that there are concerns about that. And of course, if you were to go back and look at some of the court cases that have come about, there's a lot of question marks and even some gray areas yet. And, you know, when is the request actually filed and when does the clock start running? I know they tried to clear some of those things up, so... it's just a tough area of law, and it's nice that we've had this debate today. And but as far as my district, there isn't anything specific on that area.
Thank you.
Seeing no further discussion, Representative Markwart renews his motion that House Bill 568 be recommended to pass as amended and be sent to Commerce Committee. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, same sign.
No. Aye.
The motion does not prevail. The amendment will not go to Commerce, or the bill will not be sent to Commerce.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Markwart and all of you who testified. Next on the agenda is House Bill 558, Representative Hornstein.
This is a done deal.
Next council election.
Next question.
You're always welcome in the committee, Representative Horstein. Welcome to the table.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members. Mr. Chair, I have a short amendment. I don't know if you wanted me to move that first or just move the bill. Or
okay, Representative Hornstein, does this have to go to GovOps?
My understanding is that it deals with elections, and so it's probably appropriate.
Right.
Although, is elections still under the rubric of...
Civil law.
So first the civil law?
Now, I'd love for it to go to the floor, but, you know, I
okay.
It seems like there's probably at least another stop for it. So wherever, it would seem that either GovOps or the committee that deals with elections would be appropriate.
Representative Hornstein moves House Bill 558 be recommended to pass and be sent to civil law committee. Representative Hornstein, you have an amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, there is an A1 amendment, which I believe is in your packet. It's very short, and I just wanted to move that so we could get the bill in final order here.
Okay, Representative Hornstein moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the order that he would like it. And Representative Hornstein, is this the one that simply changes the dollar figure?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, this bill actually, the version we have originated in the Senate with Senator Wieger, and when I looked it over, I didn't want Met Council members who were being elected to then have their salary cut significantly. So I wanted our House version to just simply reflect the status quo that a Met Council member should make $20,000, which is the current figure.
Representative Hornstein, as the author and a member of the committee, do you want to just incorporate this?
Yes, please.
Okay,
Mr. Chair.
The A1 amendment is incorporated into the bill, House File 558. And Representative Hornstein, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief because I know we're winding down here. I wanted to thank you, first of all, for hearing the bill. And, Mr. Chair, you've taught me and I think other members the value of legislative history when we consider things. And the Elected Met Council has a rich history in this body. And in the decade of the 90s, there's a handout, which is a Star Tribune editorial dated May 9, 1997. In that year, this bill passed both bodies and was on a bipartisan basis and was vetoed by then-Governor Carlson. And then the following year, the bill was also on the floor of the House and lost by one vote. So this is certainly a matter that has received a lot of legislative interest, and that's been introduced several times recently and hasn't been heard. We've had amendments on it, but I think this is a good process, Mr. Chair, to just have it heard as a clean bill in committee and have a good debate on it. So I appreciate that very much. Mr. Chair and members, the purpose of this bill is to help make one of the most important levels of government in our state and our region more accountable to its citizens by having its members elected. Members and Mr. Chair, the Metropolitan Council is the third largest level of government in the state, behind, of course, the state of Minnesota and Hennepin County. Its budget is in excess of $600 million. It has significant taxing authority. And so, therefore, a government entity with this much responsibility and this large, I believe, needs and deserves to be elected in order for it to have the legitimacy to carry out its very important mission. And, Mr. Chair and members, we've heard from the Met Council in their overview to this committee about its mission, so I don't want to spend too much time on that. But I think the mission of the Met Council to engage in regional planning, dealing with wastewater treatment and transit, is more important now than ever. And with a million more people moving into the region in the next 30 years, this is an agency that's going to continue to be very relevant and very important. And I believe for that reason, taxpayers and other citizens who want and need to be engaged in the work of the Met Council ought to have the opportunity to elect its members. And so, Mr. Chair, what I'd like to just briefly do, and I know there's a number of members that have questions and want to discuss this, and I want to leave time for that, is to briefly go over the bill and explain some of its provisions. You'll see that in the first sections 1, 2, 3, and 4, really sections 1 through 29, this is really, should be familiar to members because this is really a reiteration of basic election law in the state, an election law that governs our work for the most part, and simply adds the Met Council to the basic campaign finance rubric that we work under. We have provisions here for public subsidies similar to how we run. The reason for that, I think there were some concerns that maybe only wealthy individuals or those with strong financial interest in the workings of the council would be able to run and get elected more easily. And so we've anticipated that and dealt with that by ensuring that the Met Council also abide by the same kinds of contribution limits and campaign laws as we're governed by. There's also a study in Section 30, and the reason for that is and if this bill is enacted this year, there'll be a two-year period. And I want to emphasize that this bill is in no way an indictment of the current Met Council or its chair, who I think are doing good work given very substantial financial challenges. So this bill would not take effect. There would not be an election until the primary in 2006. But in the interim time, we want to use that period to see if there is some restructuring reform that could take place prior to the election. So we want to look at a study to see if the Met Council, if there's existing functions that county governments in the region are involved with, you know, correctional facilities, for example. Each county has their own, and is there a way that that can be made more efficient under a metropolitan framework? There was some, the last time this was done resulted in, you know, the wastewater treatment and transit functions being under one roof at the Met Council. And I think that has really increased efficiencies and has been beneficial to the region to have those functions together at the Met Council. So this doesn't mandate that. It just simply says let's spend a couple of years and study this over before we start electing council members, which looks like in would be in the fall of 2006. So with that, members, I'd be happy to answer questions we can move forward. Well, I guess my last point here is, and I know there will probably be some questions about the election methodology, et cetera, and when we deal with this in civil law, we can get into more details, and I'm very open to ideas that members may have on this. For example, I talked to one suburban mayor who you know, likes the bill, but she had suggested maybe staggered terms. That there were some issues with that. I'm very open to incorporating that. I think our goal here today is to acknowledge, yes, we ought to have an election, or no, we'll continue along the status quo, which really amounts to taxation without representation. So, Mr. Chair and members, I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Representative Grockwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before I ask any questions or offer any opinions, I want to make sure that I'm showing proper deference and esteem to the highly respected representative from Minneapolis, and to make sure that I'm in no way intended to be disrespectful. I know you served on the Met Council before, but on this issue I think we have differing opinions. I was glad to see when I was reading this bill last evening that this is a nonpartisan ballot. However, would this preclude local parties, organizations from endorsing candidates?
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Greville. I assure you that any question is fine, and we'll continue to move along and work together. I think that the best model to look at for this would be county elections, and I think most of our city elections are also nonpartisan. And I think in the end that's probably up to political parties. I know they make endorsements for these kinds of races in the metropolitan area, but the party designation would not be listed on the ballot. But I don't think it's really our role to tell parties, well, no, yes or no, you can't make an endorsement for this kind of a race.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Grockwell.
Speaking as a former BPLU chairman, I can say that if this bill does become law, I would expect that my Senate district and many other areas would, in fact, seek endorsement for this position. And as I take a look at the Met Council map that I have of the 16 districts, using the red and blue mentality of measuring out these districts, if this statute became law, we'd pretty much guarantee a Republican majority in the Met Council. I marked off some of these districts. I don't know, maybe I should be quiet and I should just vote for the bill. But when I look at this, I see a lot of these districts that are pretty solid Republican areas, and as the demographics shift, as more population to these fast-growing areas continue, we're going to see the strength of my party, I guess, in the Met Council be almost a structural configuration of it. Do you have any opinion on that? Or?
Representative Hornstein.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and Representative Garofalo. You know, the issue here is that these Met Council members should, in fact, reflect their districts. And my calculations are that it would be a much more even split, and it would be like any other area. There'd be some swing districts, and you know, unfortunately, this would not change the current issue, which is that these districts would be subject to being redrawn with reapportionment as they are now. So it's still somewhat of a political process. The legislature draws these districts and would continue to do so. But I'm not so concerned about red and blue as I am with people having the right to exercise a choice and for people to be engaged in the work of the Metropolitan Council. you know, this is a very, as I said before, a very, very important agency, and you don't have Met Council members, and not that they're expected to now. This isn't a criticism, again, of the current members, but they're not going around having town meetings. They're not, I think there's a lot of consultation that goes on between Met Council members and city councils and city governments, but I think the average citizen, if you were to ask your constituents, would probably not be able to identify who their Met Council member is. Yet their Met Council member is representing them on matters, important matters of taxation, overseeing a budget of over $600 million, which is the third largest in the state. So this will be a very important and spirited issue. I don't think the parties really pay a lot of attention to metropolitan issues. So I'm not as concerned as you are, Representative Garofalo, about the redness of
sure. Mr. Chairman,
what's up, Garofalo?
As you mentioned, the fact that there's no town hall meetings, people don't know who these people are, not really representing their areas. But isn't really one of the purposes of the Met Council in fact be a regional agency that it was sort of meant as a check that because of the local pressures on local communities, sometimes we're not looking out in the best interest of the entire region. And in fact, by electing representatives and going to a sort of a balkanization of the metro area and the Met Council, that would in fact kind of ruin that charter for the organization.
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, again, I think that's a legitimate concern. Again, people will be representing their districts and representing their interests. But what I found as a Metropolitan Council member is that on issues of transit, of regional wastewater, of planning for the region, planning infrastructure in a way that's efficient and effective for taxpayers, you tend to want to go towards regional solutions. So if you're concerned about spending public money effectively and efficiently, there's going to be a certain amount of working together. There's also going to be a certain amount of parochialism, and that took place when our council was appointed. There were at least two examples where people really advocated for their district correctly or incorrectly, and I thought that was their right and their prerogative.
Sure. Final question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Garofalo.
I was happy to see also in the bill that you did provide for the $500 contribution limit on these positions. I would assume, however, that just like in our state races where we've seen sort of the 21st century model for elections where 527s have influenced the process, that we would also see those 527s being involved in the Met Council elections. And while $25,000 seems like a lot to a guy like you or me, for builders who are dealing with multi-million dollar projects, we might end up in a case similar to what we have in Alabama now, where they're electing their state Supreme Court justices and they're running on TV with these huge contributions. Do you have any concerns about that and that concentration of a lot of money influencing the Met Council elections?
Representative Horne.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Garofalo, we have a lot more in common than I thought. I think that this issue is you're absolutely right to point out the influence of big money in politics and the need for more campaign finance reform. There's some legislation that Representative Dabney has on fair and clean elections that's really important. I'd encourage people to look it over. I don't know if he's introduced it this year, but he did 2 years ago. And you're absolutely right. This election will be subject to the same kinds of problems that any election that we have currently in terms of big money influence. But the best thing we can do to curb that is to at least give people an opportunity to be able to get reimbursement like we do. We're probably again without additional statewide legislation related to campaign finance reform. I know Representative Johnson is holding hearings on that. This is going to be part of the broader discussion about elections, and I'm open to anyone's ideas and suggestions about this, particularly if we vote this out today and it goes to the committee that's responsible for elections. We can have that discussion. But you're right, and I think these are valid concerns, and we've done our best here to work with the existing law as far as it goes in terms of campaign finance reform.
Thank you for your patience, Representative.
Thank you.
Representative Sharon.
Well, I thank my colleague, Representative Garofalo, a chance to let me get a word in here. far be it that
that I would even talk about legitimizing another level of bureaucracy and legitimizing it with an election. I wish we were talking about abolishing the Met Council here instead of about whether we're going to elect them. But that being said, it's a bureaucracy that's grown so much that I think regretfully it may be here to stay. And that being the case, and certainly seeing that the Supreme Court has, in its recent ruling, has given the Met Council the power to dictate to other elected officials, I think that that this is a good bill, and I'll be supporting it. It's a bureaucracy that has the power to tax, and I think, as I'm already on the record as saying, I thought we settled this in 1776 about taxation and representation. It's a group that has a police force, if you want to call the transit police a police force, and they can be armed. So I think that they need to be accountable to the citizens, and so I'll be supporting your bill.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Hornstein, you and I are the two members who have had the opportunity to serve on that body. And I think what I'd like to do, Mr. Chairman, is make a distinct impression upon this body, if I could, that I had to defend this question of electing or appointing the Met Council. And my argument was always to appoint. And the reason I did that was I was appointed under Governor Carlson. My district was District 5, which was Bloomington, and then half of Savage and half of Shakopee. Because I had such a long history in Bloomington and had a strong base, I began to spend my efforts in Savage and Shakopee because I didn't know that world, and that's where I really had to advocate for. I also thought that if I had been elected, and it was going to take 20,000 votes to get myself that job, I'd get them all out of Bloomington. That's just because there was that much of a base. And so I always felt that, like the Hennepin County, I have seen situations where Hennepin County commissioners serve for life. I mean, once you become a Hennepin County commissioner, it's very, very difficult to get defeated because the districts are so big and so diverse and it takes so much money that they become very dominant and are there for a very long time. I also would say that I was appointed under Governor Carlson, and then when Governor Ventura came in, he appointed the chair was Ted Mondale. And Senator Mondale was then able to pick people who he felt comfortable with, and I was replaced then with a gentleman by the name of Phil Revness. Phil was a friend of mine out of Bloomington, a former senator. He knew very well what was going on and was very, very capable of that. And so in that selection process, when you look at the chemistry of the Met Council, these people have great pedigrees in public policy and public organization, and they know these communities. And I've suggested to people that the electorate many times does not select the same quality of people that the appointment process does.
Present company excluded.
Present company. And the third thing, so I would argue then, because you could dominate with an electorate. Number two, the election doesn't necessarily mean quality. And number three, when you think about the Met Council is basically, after we've heard the presentation, it's a large operating utility. Sure, they do planning. The controversial part is the planning, and when they went out to Lake Elmo, it was a bloodbath. And yet, because they're appointed, they take that reasoning and their decision very seriously. But beyond that, their utility operations are bussing and flushing. I mean, that's it, bussing and flushing. And sure, they have this huge, huge budget, but they run the sewer pipes in the ground, and if they have to fix them, they can go right into a community and they dig up the street and they fix that pipe. They don't have to be elected. They just go do it. And they have taken bus strikes one after another, and they don't get caught up in the tremendous pressure that a bus strike brings to we, and Mr. Armstrong, you went through this. We're not elected, so we have to do the right thing. So it sounds great on paper. I know the taxation question. I understand that, but this is a big operating utility. It has high quality people on it, and I'm just concerned that the electoral process will really mess it up. End of statement. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Hornstein.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, how does the governor feel about your bill?
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. That's a good question, Representative Hornstein. I haven't talked with the governor. My understanding is, you know, the Met Council is I think, somewhat neutral on it. You know, they're doing their work as they should be. All I know, Representative Anderson, Mr. Chair, on the governor is that he has voted on the floor in support of it once, and he voted against it another time. So, and I think it went in 97. He voted for it, and 98. He voted against it. In 97, he also authored it. So, hard to know. That's all the research I was able to do on the governor's position.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to have a roll call.
Roll call being requested. There will be a roll call vote. Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein. I'm looking on page 17, lines 14 to 17. It says, no county commissioner shall hold another elected office during tenure as commissioner except to serve as an elected Metropolitan Council member. Is that a conflict of interest there? I don't know if is there any check and balance not being used here. Having a county commissioner also being a Met Council. I mean, I guess as a member of Dakota County, I wouldn't mind it because it's my commissioner, but is that a good thing?
No,
Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein.
There was at one time an effort to make county commissioners the Met Council members, and I oppose that. I think, you know, we need some new blood in there. You know, this subdivision, I don't think is critical to this bill, and if the committee felt some discomfort with this, you raise a valid question, and you know, I don't think lines 13 to 16 are 100% necessary. This is, you know, the language that came over from the author in the Senate. I'm not wed to it. I think you raise a valid concern. If you'd want to delete that, Representative Wardlow, I'd be fine with that.
Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure myself how I feel about that, other than it just struck me as a possible conflict of interest.
I think that's a valid concern.
To this point, Representative Schultz?
Yes, I for one would like to strike those words. Having someone serving in two different elected offices, I think, is a conflict, and I would move that we strike lines.
Representative Schultz, could you state the line and page and line?
Page 17, lines, and it's subdivision 1, lines 13 through the final word on 17, through the period on 17.
Mr. Chair.
We could just strike, accept the service, and no county commissioner shall hold another elected office during his tenure as commissioner, nor be employed by the county, period. So we would have to strike the words that are underlined.
That would be, Representative Schroen, the proper motion would be to delete that language. New language you delete, and existing language you strike.
Mr. Chairman, I think actually we could just delete Section 24 because that's the only effect of Section 24 in its entirety.
I would so move.
Representative Schroen?
I would so move that.
And House Bill 558 by...
Deleting Section 24.
Any discussion to that motion? Representative Fornstein.
Mr. Chair, I view that as a friendly amendment.
Okay. Do you want to just incorporate that for time's sake?
Sure.
Representative Hornstein incorporates that amendment. Section 24 is deleted from the bill. Any further discussion? Excuse me. You got to get back on track. Representative Wardlow, do you have anything else?
No, thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you.
Members, I do need to know we're running out of time. If the committee wants to lay this over, we can continue beyond, or if we get to run out of time, we have that option, but Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief.
I do intend to vote for your bill. I think that this is long overdue. Having come from a community where we had conflicts with the Metropolitan Council, didn't necessarily have the representation on the board. They didn't have the same vision as our area. It was very, very difficult. And every time a new governor came in, we saw the change in philosophy and policy. And so to have the continuity of an election, I think, would be very effective.
Further discussion? Representative Kamar.
Real quickly, Mr. Chair, Representative Horstein, do you know if Portland or Indianapolis or some of the other areas that have regional governments have elected bodies?
Representative Horstein.
Mr. Chair and Representative Paymore, yes, Portland does have an elected, they call it the Metro, my understanding is that it's working very well, as a matter of fact, I'd wanted to contact, there is someone some groups here, some organizations concerned about land use and open space. No one of the members at Portland. It was my intention to try to contact them today. I wasn't able to get a hold of them, but from what I've read and what I know about the model in Portland, it is working well, and they manage a regional growth area there, parks and open spaces, and do a good job there. It hasn't been controversial. It's worked well.
Thank you. Real quickly, I said, having been around in 1996 when the bill was last in the legislature, I would hope that this committee would at least allow the bill to get to the House floor. I think the entire House of Representatives would really like to hear the debate on this issue. It's very important. I respect Representative Peterson's comments, but if you took that to a logical conclusion, then why don't we just have the governor appoint the legislature, and that would be more efficient and perhaps more effective. But not necessarily Democrat, more Democratic. So I...
more Republican.
That's true. It might be for the moment. But I hope people don't perceive this as being a partisan issue, because we don't know who the next governor is going to be, and so... this is setting the table for future Met Councils down the line. It's not going away, and nor should it. Unlike some members here, I think the Met Council is a good thing. We need regional government with the increases in population. We're running out of time here, but I would hope that you'd at least allow the whole body to have a debate on this rather than killing it here in committee.
Any other comments from Representative Hornstein? And we're at the end of our list. Members, we can hold this over, but Mr. Sutton, with the Met Council, if you have some brief comments, I don't want to cut you off. If you can object if you feel we need to hold this over. But.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Judge Sutton, and I work with the Metropolitan Council. I'm the Government Affairs Director, and I just wanted to take the opportunity to respond to Representative Anderson's question where the governor was at on this bill. The governor, as Representative Hornstein has said, has voted for and voted against this bill in the past. Currently, he is satisfied with the way that the council is structured as an appointed committee. However, he also knows that the Metropolitan Council is a creature of the legislature, and it is up to the legislature to decide. One of the reasons why he is comfortable with where we're at right now is because there is a number of ways that the legislature and the governor oversee the council. One, obviously the governor appoints all of the members of the council. Two, the legislature sets the levy limits for our property taxes. We come back to the legislature every year, or not every year, last was 2003, to get our levy set for our general purpose levy, our livable communities levy, and also our right-of-way access loan fund for roads. We also have, which was created in 2003, a legislative commission on metropolitan governance, which Representative Hornstein and Representative Holberg both serve on, which is made up of 14 members of the legislature, 7 from the Senate, 7 from the House, 4 from each majority, and 3 from each minority, which have it is their purpose to review our capital and operating budgets and also the internal functions of the council's activities. So at that point, the governor is comfortable with where we are at right now. We see that that is there's plenty of oversight at that point. But again, he is realizing that this is the decision that the legislature has to make.
If there's, if there's no further discussion, Representative Hornstein renews his motion that House File 558 be recommended to pass as amended and be sent to civil law. Seeing no further discussion, roll call being requested, the clerk will take the roll.
Lanning?
No.
Lanning votes no. Anderson?
No.
Anderson votes no. Sharon?
Aye.
Sharon votes aye. Cornish?
No.
Cornish votes no. Garofalo?
No.
Garofalo votes no. Hillstrom?
Yes.
Hillstrom votes aye. Holbert?
Yes.
Holbert votes aye. Hornstein?
Yes.
Hornstein votes aye. Hosh?
Yes.
Hosh votes aye. Lincheski?
She's gone. She votes aye.
Markwart.
Yes.
That didn't sound like her at all. Markwart.
Yes.
Markwart votes aye. Paymar.
Yes.
Paymar votes aye. Peterson.
Does Bloomington get two votes now?
No.
Votes no.
Peterson votes no. Poppy.
Aye.
Poppy votes aye. Samuelson.
Aye.
Samuelson votes aye. Stalzi.
Aye.
Stalzi votes aye. Powell.
Yes.
Powell votes aye. Wardlow.
Yes.
Wardlow votes aye. Olson.
No.
Olson votes no. Oops.
There being 12 ayes and 6 nays, the motion prevails. The bill is recommended to pass and be sent to civil law.
Thank you, Member.
Mr. Chair, can I make a quick comment?
Yes, you
can. Just based on this vote. You know, you wanted to establish a democratic way of doing this. And just by the fact that you voted no, you may never have heard this bill if it wasn't for this democratic process. So I appreciate that, and I think it's working.
Representative Markwart, I put this number one on the list, even though I was voting no.
Well, yeah.
Because I don't put things on the list simply because I want them to pass. And I think this deserved a hearing, and I'm glad this body just made the decision it did, even though I don't agree with it.
And Mr. Chair, you're living up to exactly what you said you would, and I commend you for that. Thank you.
Thank you for the encouragement. Yeah. I appreciate everybody working with it. I hope more of you will send back the responses in the prioritization process and participate more fully, because I really hope we prevail in setting the trend here and being more bipartisan and democratic, if you will, in this republic. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The meeting is adjourned if there's no objection.